in Northern California are operated by Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E. And the company claims that all is well at their facilities, despite verifiable evidence to the contrary. They say that we're supposed to trust them rather than any naysayers. But should we? And then you hear from a genuine expert on the matter.
PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is in bankruptcy. And they are also under criminal parole. They actually have a parole officer because they were convicted of federal crimes related to the 2010 gas explosion in San Bruno, where they incinerated 19 homes and killed 8 people. And now, of course, they've burnt down half of Northern California and killed 80 people. And you have to ask, is this company suitable to be running a nuclear power plant?
Well, when you put it that way, Harvey Wasserman, you make it abundantly clear that if you're living anywhere near the Diablo Canyon nuclear power facility, you, your family, your neighbors, and everyone around you is smack dab in the middle of that seat that we don't like, but we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we take a close-up look at what's happening at the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors in Northern California by speaking with three veteran activists. Harvey Wasserman has been in the anti-nuke wars since before Three Mile Island. He's also a journalist, author, and host of the Solartopia radio program. Linda Seeley and Molly Johnson are longtime members of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, which has been monitoring Diablo Canyon since before it was built. Together, they offer some surprising insights, not only into the problems with those two reactors, but to issues of nuclear waste storage and transport, as well as a window of opportunity that exists to shut those suckers down before they run out their operating licenses. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Robert Mueller has yet released from his investigation. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 12, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. In the U.S., Donald Trump again will propose funding to restart the licensing process to make Yucca Mountain a nuclear waste repository. The Trump budget will include $116 million in the Department of Energy budget to restart licensing for the Yucca Mountain project and fund a, quote, robust interim storage program, end quote. The spending blueprint will also include $39 million for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to work on licensing Yucca Mountain. You'll learn what's wrong with these suggestions in today's interviews. The Environmental Protection Agency, in a numbnuts-adjacent move, proposed relaxing standards related to how it assesses the effects of exposure to low-level toxic chemicals on public health, and specifically nuclear radiation. The Los Angeles Times has obtained correspondence that reveals just how deeply industry lobbyists and a controversial industry-funded toxicologist were in drafting the federal agency's proposal to scrap its current protective approach to regulating toxic exposure. This departure from the long-held linear no-threshold approach to regulating the study of toxins, that once a substance is found to be harmful at one level, the danger applies at all levels. And in other words, there is no safe level of radiation exposure. We're going to link to this article. It's really important. Bad news for hundreds of American sailors who filed two class action suits claiming to have suffered physical abnormalities, cancer, and death stemming from exposure to radiation while on an humanitarian mission to Fukushima, Japan in 2011. On March 3rd, Monday, their cases were dismissed, paving the way for their claims to be brought in Japan, which is something that cannot happen because of time, distance, and illness on the part of the plaintiffs. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has extended the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant's license to 2050, despite the fact that it doesn't even expire until 2030. A preemptive nuclear industry move, despite the facts that opponents have cited concerns about growing cracks in the plant's concrete containment dome and other critical parts of the sprawling complex. A new federal lawsuit alleges that federal contractors at the Savannah River site accepted tickets to University of Alabama football games, the Masters Golf Tournament, NASCAR races, and plenty of swag in exchange for handing out work at the nuclear storage facility. And, of course, the cost of those kickbacks were then charged to taxpayers, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. In Ohio, the Department of Transportation snowplows have been spreading Aqua Selena, a de-icing solution, on state roadways for years. Last year, an environmental group obtained and released a 2017 report that found high levels of radioactivity in the product, and tests from four counties showed that all samples contain elevated levels of radioactivity in excess of state limits on the discharge of radioactive materials. Over to Japan, where Greenpeace Japan has released a report stating that the Japanese government is deliberately misleading United Nations human rights bodies and experts over the ongoing nuclear crisis in areas of Fukushima, revealing and documenting high levels of radiation in both exclusion zones and open areas, even after huge decontamination efforts. We're working on an interview about this story. In a Numbnuts adjacent report, Malaysian designer Jimmy Choo of Choo's Shoes unveiled a one-off range of shoes in Japan made using materials and techniques native to the disaster-hit Fukushima area. No word if they glow in the dark. Internationally, a bit of good news. South Africa has just ratified the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. In Taiwan, the Ministry of Economic Affairs has published a revised national energy strategy that calls for the abolition of nuclear power by 2025, along with reductions in the use of fossil fuels. In Scotland, cracks in a nuclear reactor at Hunterston B Power Station show 370 hairline fractures, which equates to about one in every 10 graphite bricks, which makes up the core of the reactor. What to do? That's easy. Operator EDF plans to ask the regulator for permission to restart with a new operational limit of up to 700 cracks. In the UK, a law has been changed so that nuclear waste dumps can be forced on local communities. And in Finland, safety problems have been found at Areva's Finnish reactor even before the thing starts up. And if that's not enough for you, here's
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Bizarro World. Remember in Superman comics? That was the place where everything was fractured and backwards. Well, peak nuclear Bizarro World was reached with the Fukushima anniversary posting in Forbes of Michael Schellenberger's piece entitled, "It sounds crazy, but Fukushima, Chernobyl, and Three Mile Island show why nuclear is inherently safe." Say what? Oh, I get it. Bad is good, good is bad, and wait a minute. Didn't George Orwell warn us about this kind of stuff in his book on creeping totalitarianism, 1984? You know, don't even bother reading this nonsense. First, know that Forbes owner and editor-in-chief Steve Forbes is heavily invested in nuclear and likes to protect his money. He has a stable of select Judas goats on staff who happily carry out his bidding. And the Schillberger is well known for writing nonsense like this. He is an ultimate nuclear shill. But how can this be justified? Don't we have to respond? The answer? Don't even try. As longtime Nuclear Hot Seat listener Jim Torson explained, it's a perfect example of something called Gish Gallop. That's a technique used during debating that focuses on overwhelming one's opponent with as many arguments as possible without regard for accuracy or strength of the arguments. That's meant to eat up our time, energy, and mental bandwidth, which could better be used fighting nukes directly. So if this article infuriates you, especially given the insult that it came out on the anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, use the energy of anger that is generated to do something to battle nukes directly. And know that in the Numbnuts Hall of Shame, Michael Schellenberger, the Shillberger, is once again...
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week!
We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, as I've been sharing on the show, yes, I am going to Three Mile Island for the 40th anniversary of that nuclear meltdown. And this is thanks to the help of many, many listeners. I am so grateful for your help and support. I will be at TMI as activists and media from around the world converge at the site of the world's first commercial nuclear reactor meltdown. I will be there not only as a survivor, but to bear witness, interview other survivors, activists, and experts, and bring you the full story from those who lived through that horrifying experience and still live with its aftermath. But here's the thing. In order to incorporate all the events and all the interviews I've lined up, because things have expanded, I've had to extend the trip for 2 days past what I initially planned and budgeted for. That means there are still a whole host of expenses I'll need to cover. And that means I still need your help. Can you empower me on this journey with a small donation to help me cover this once-in-a-lifetime anniversary at Three Mile Island? If you can, please, do so now. It's easy to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to make a one-time donation. And for those of you who can donate $100 or more, I will provide you as a thank you a copy of my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. And I'll sign it to you in any way you wish. Whatever you can do to help, know that you're going to help me get back to the scene of the crime and report upon it. And for that, you have my deepest gratitude. Here are this week's featured interviews. California's only operating nuclear reactors at Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo County have more than their share of problems, as our guests will explain. First up, Linda Seeley and Molly Johnson, who are longtime members of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. The group has been holding Pacific Gas and Electric's feet to the fire since before the reactors were built, to make certain that they adhere to the highest standards for safety. Now, problems with the facility are mounting, and what seems like Nuclear Regulatory Commission oversight has turned into NRC overlooking any problems or safety lapses. So it's up to Mothers for Peace and their allies who are pushing for safety not only now, but into the radioactive spent fuel rad waste future. We spoke on Sunday, March 10.
Linda Seeley and Molly Johnson, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's start out with a little bit of background for people who may not be aware of the group. What is San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace?
I'm Linda. Mothers for Peace started back in 1969. We are celebrating our 50th anniversary this year, which is pretty exceptional, I think. But it started as an anti-war group during the Vietnam War, providing young men with options for, rather than going to war, for becoming conscientious objectors or other things to do instead of having to go to the war. I did not live in the area then. I moved here in 82. But actually what happened was PG&E put an ad in the newspaper saying that they were planning on building a nuclear power plant here. And one of our founding members put an ad in the paper saying, Is anybody else interested in exploring this issue with me? They didn't even know what a nuclear power plant was. So Mothers for Peace, with its original members, which were about four or five, started learning about nuclear power and then applied to be the legal intervener in matters about safety at Diablo Canyon, and we've had that role ever since. And some of the founding members are still members, by the way.
It's very interesting that the nuclear industry loves to tout Diablo Canyon as one of the safest nuclear power plants in the country. What they fail to mention is the reason they are is because Mothers for Peace has, throughout the years, made sure that they did, and many, many times have gone and filed suit with the NRC to make sure things were done right.
What is the current situation at Diablo Canyon?
PG&E, about 2 years ago, entered into an agreement with several environmental groups, NRDC being one, Friends of the Earth being another. There were some other, like labor unions, et cetera, that were involved in that. Basically, in 2024 and 2025 is when the license expires for Diablo Canyon. For many years, it was thought that, as with all the other nuclear power plants, they would ask for relicensing, which the NRC would rubber stamp because that's what they do. But actually, PG&E discovered that Diablo Canyon is just way too expensive to run. And so this deal was really great for them. They pretty much got a lot of concessions and have agreed to close in 2025 and not ask for relicensing. So at this point, there's the decommissioning that we're all having to learn about. Linda is on the decommissioning panel in San Luis Obispo County that is looking into the issues that go along with the closing of the plant. So not only the decommissioning, but also what's going to happen to the waste that's there. That's kind of where we are at this point.
That's always the issue with a nuclear reactor that never gets addressed when people start talking about clean, green, and carbon-free is, oh, yes, and then there's all that radioactive nuclear waste that has to be taken care of forever.
I've been reading about it. We're having our next decommissioning meeting this coming Wednesday, our big community meeting. And in February 22nd and 23rd, we had two community workshops where representatives from different dry cask storage companies came and told us about the kinds of casks that are available for storage of nuclear fuel. First of all, Mothers for Peace takes the position that it needs to stay on site. We made it. We're responsible for it. So what we have to do is keep it in the absolutely safest way possible. Plus, it's dangerous to ship it. Molly will talk about the consolidated interim storage, which is a nightmare, and there's no permanent repository. So our only choice, basically, is to leave it right where it is on an earthquake zone with 13 earthquake faults identified, two major earthquake faults right on the edge of the ocean. So what our mission, our job, is to find out what is the best way to store this stuff. Like you said, Libby, it's radioactive essentially forever. We have to keep it out of the biosphere, keep it away from the future generations. So what do we do? And right now it's being stored in these casks manufactured by a company called Holtec. And I was just reading a report that was done by the Nuclear Energy Institute in 2014. It's the latest report we have about the Holtec canisters. And it's quite frightening because the air at the ocean, as everybody knows, is filled with salt and moisture. And that salt goes in and deposits on the canisters, which can cause the conditions for cracking to start happening in the canisters. And you do not want to have a cracked nuclear waste canister. That's about the last thing you want to have.
And what that means is all it takes is a microscopic crack for that stuff to start going out into the environment. And we've got the same problem with the Holtec canisters here in Southern California, that
They're sealed. They can't be monitored. There's no way to fix them. There's no way to remove the waste once it's put in there. It's basically you put it in a tin can, and the only way to get it out again is to use a can opener and open that tin can. But there are no controls at all.
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons that we've been doing a lot of studying on this to try to find out what is the safest way, because there is no safe way. Everyone must understand that there is no safe way to store this stuff. There's only ways that are less harmful than others. So in our studies, one of the things that struck me and the rest of us is that in Japan, they have dry cask storage. Now, their dry casks are made out of ductile iron. They're, I think, 16 to 19 inches thick. But even more importantly than that, they are stored in a building, a very robust building. That storage was not affected in any way by the earthquake or the tsunami in Japan. And to this day, they still have not found any problems associated with those canisters.
And those were the canisters at Fukushima Daiichi, correct?
At Fukushima Daiichi, yes. And so to me, that's it. Okay, that's pretty strong evidence that this is where they must be stored. Now, the canister cask situation needs to be studied. It makes sense that the thicker casks are better, but there's been no study to compare the two by an independent scientific body. But definitely, they need to be in a building where they can be monitored, where the waste can be retrieved, where things can be repaired if necessary. And most importantly, if something did happen, the radioactivity would be contained to the building and not released to the environment.
What can you tell me about your group's position on Yucca Mountain, which, of course, is continuously being flogged as our permanent repository?
I have been working on the Yucca Mountain issue for almost 30 years. I've actually been inside the tunnel, and it was kind of a scary experience because you walk in, and the first thing that you notice is the wall. Yucca Mountain is very fractured. So internationally, there's kind of a basis for looking for a long-term repository, and four of the top things are, A, no repository should ever be placed above an aquifer because they know that whatever repository is used, eventually it's going to leak radioactivity. So no way can it be above an aquifer for obvious reasons. There's one. Number two, moisture. It needs to be in a dry environment. People may think, oh, Nevada, it's dry. Well, yeah, it is, but Yucca Mountain is very fractured. There's a lot of water that seeps into Yucca Mountain. They had actually talked about building titanium shields that would be placed over the cask to protect them from this water. The other thing is volcanic activity. You know, you don't want to place it where it could possibly be blown sky high volcanically. Yucca Mountain in that area is still considered volcanically active, even though it hasn't blown up in a very long time. There's still that possibility. And the fourth thing is earthquake. Yucca Mountain is an earthquake zone. Those four things right there disallow Yucca Mountain as a place to permanently store high-level radioactive waste.
Then why do you think the government and the nuclear industry keeps flogging Yucca Mountain as its ultimate destination for waste?
Because it's easy. Originally, there were three sites that were chosen as possible repositories. There was Yucca Mountain, there was a site in New England, and there was another site, I believe, in the Midwest. Then the politics took over. And because Nevada is a small state with a small population, and what the nuclear industry perceived as not a lot of political power, they ditched the other two and went with Yucca. This is their fallback. So they just keep pushing it. And it's not going to happen. And what happened was that the state of Nevada ended up being more politically powerful than they had anticipated. So the state of Nevada has fought this and will continue to fight it. What needs to happen is we need to have a serious discussion about finding a repository, get the National Academy of Sciences or someone involved to find a truly scientifically sound way of storing this waste. Again, not safe, just safer than leaving it at nuclear power plants or buried in the desert somewhere.
Along with this goes the latest bright idea, put that in quotes, from the nuclear industry, and that is consolidated interim storage, where the waste is, in essence, sent to a dump before it's sent to a dump. What's wrong with this picture?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Yes, consolidated interim storage. So there's two different projects that are happening right now. There's one in southeastern New Mexico, right around Carlsbad. The waste distillation pilot plant is located there. There's a uranium processing plant there, and it is a poor community of color. This is who the nuclear industry targets. It's how I got really involved in this because I work with Indian tribes, and actually we stopped a dump in the California desert. But this is who they attack. And again, it is people they see as not able to be politically strong. So in southern New Mexico, it's just horrible. What you hear a lot from people that are pro, they'll say, oh, but the state wants it. The people down there want it. Well, I can tell you unequivocally that no, the people there do not want it. They have formed groups to fight it. And it's just a bad idea all the way around. First of all, putting all of the waste in one location that is not secure. This is a partially below level repository. So the canisters are kind of like at San Onofre, where they're partially buried, but not completely. So there you go. You have all the waste in the country in one spot. They're asking to be able to store 140,000 tons of this stuff, although they keep varying that.
Because they never know how much of it is going to be created by the time they actually have to do this, because the dump does not exist. Right now, it's just the political battle.
Correct. But thankfully, here, something that's happened in New Mexico, which is really wonderful, is that there is a new governor and there is new people in the state government. So the old governor was definitely for the consolidated interim storage, which we call CIS. But the new governor and the new other people in this New Mexico government are not. They are totally against this project and, in fact, have now gone to the NRC to ask that the New Mexico Environmental Department become a party to this whole project so that they can oppose it. So that's good news.
So at this point, with the problems with radioactive waste, which is being created all the time, that nuclear reactors are in operation, and we've still got 99 of those suckers cranking away here in this country. Go over the list that Mothers for Peace came up with of the various things that need to be done in order to be best possible, not a good idea, but we can't do any better until we come up with a better solution.
Well, first of all, quit making it.
that might be an idea.
That's number one. That's number one. You know, when your bathtub is overflowing, what do? What's the first thing you do? You turn off the water. Same thing with this. We're overflowing with nuclear waste. Let's turn off the faucet. Stop making it and start dealing with the waste we have. And it's not just the high-level waste either. People need to remember that. There's also what is called low-level radioactive waste. This is not harmless, inert stuff. And it also gets shipped around the country. And there are actually 5 low-level radioactive waste dumps in this country that are leaking radioactivity. So the whole scenario is just bad.
Given that there is no perfect solution or effective solution long-term for radioactive waste, what are the components of the best possible storage for it as put together in a position paper by Mothers for Peace?
Well, first of all, we want the irradiated waste to stay on site. Because, for one thing, high-level nuclear waste has never been transported on the highways. And these are huge containers that they have to move in. And if any of you have ever been to Diablo Canyon, you'll know that the entry and exit road out of Avila Beach, where Diablo is located, is a very treacherous two-lane highway. One side of it has a cliff, and the other side of it steeply goes down to a creek. So it is extremely dangerous there, and not to mention all the other places across the country. The interim storage sites, as Molly said, are very dangerous if they would create an interim storage site. To have 140,000 metric tons of highly radioactive nuclear waste stuck together above ground, out in the middle of nowhere, what an invitation for somebody who has malice in their heart. Why should the country dump our refuse on a place that has no voice for itself? They didn't make the nuclear waste. Places all over the rest of the country made it. And the people and the animals and the flora in that part of the country shouldn't have to suffer the sins of others. The next thing is that we need to store it in better canisters. Like I said, I was reading this paper this morning about salts collecting on the outside of the canisters at Diablo Canyon with a report that was done in 2014. Salts lead to cracking. Cracking leads to escape of radiation into the atmosphere. And the good part is that the contract with Holtec that PG&E has had up until this point is finished in December of 2019. So we are done with Holtec. But we need to talk about something else, Libby, about PG&E's plan for the waste at Diablo that I don't think you know about. PG&E's plan that they have publicized now is that they have stopped unloading spent nuclear fuel from the fuel pools into dry cask storage. Even though we know that dry cask storage has its problems, the consensus is that fuel stored in spent fuel pools is even more dangerous because, God forbid, there should be an earthquake or a terrorist attack. These spent fuel pools are tremendously vulnerable. And what happens is if you lose the water from a spent fuel pool, the zirconium cladding on the spent fuel can self-ignite and create just a holocaust of spent fuel that would spread all over California and across the world, probably, like Fukushima did. So what PG&E is planning to do is to keep loading up those pools. They were designed originally. We have two pools at Diablo Canyon, one for each reactor. They were designed to hold 270 spent fuel assemblies. Right now, each of them has around 700. And by the time they cease operations at Diablo Canyon, they plan on having each of them filled to 1,340 spent fuel assemblies. And then their plan is to do a giant offloading campaign where they start unloading the fuel and putting it into spent fuel canisters. And their rationale for doing this is that they're using such high burn-up fuel right now. This fuel is extraordinarily hot. And so they need a big cache of cooler spent fuel rods in the pools because when they pack these dry casks, they have to pack them in a certain configuration with the hotter fuel on the inside and the cooler fuel around the outside, because then the cooler fuel acts as a buffer to the hotter fuel. And so the total thermal load inside of the canister is acceptable. So on one hand, you can see their rationale for doing this, because ultimately they say, well, we'll get those fuel pools unloaded faster. Ultimately, it'll take like 7 years rather than 8.5 years to unload all of it. However, to balance that with the danger of having those spent fuel pools so densely packed with extremely radioactive material. On another hand, this gives us a chance, this gap here between unloading. They don't have any more spent fuel containers ready to be loaded up there. They have no more dry casks. Each dry cask is manufactured specially for each facility. So now we have this opportunity, because that Holtec contract expires, we can get a better canister. We don't have to go along with the Holtec ones. So that, in a way, is good. So our hope on our decommissioning panel is to make Diablo Canyon the paragon of spent fuel storage, a place that other plants, as they shut down, can look to for safer dry cask storage and show that it can be done. That might be pie in the sky, but that's my deepest desire.
Just a follow-up there to what Linda was talking about in the canisters and what they call high burn-up fuel, which means that the fuel rods have been in the reactor for a much longer period of time than they used to be, and so therefore they come out much more radioactive and much hotter than what they call quote-unquote low burn-up fuel. We have several casks, and as Linda explained, the hot fuel is supposed to go in the center and the cooler fuel on the outside. We have several casks at Diablo Canyon that are loaded the opposite way. The cooler fuel is inside, the hotter fuel is outside. It's a concern to us. The NRC, of course, has said, not a problem, but there's a reason that they wanted them loaded that way. So not only are we dealing with a company that wants the cheapest way out, but also one that apparently can't even make sure that things are loaded correctly in the canisters.
I ran into Harvey Wasserman at a screening yesterday for the Fukushima anniversary, an incredibly powerful film called Fukushima Speaks. And while there, he was talking about Diablo Canyon, and I did find out about certain political moves that are being planned out right now to get the plant shut down before 2024 and 2025. What involvement does Mothers for Peace have with the political actions moving forward?
Mothers for Peace wrote a letter to the governor a while back concerning our concerns about embrittlement, which is one of the things that Harvey has brought up. Embrittlement happens, especially to concrete, when it is exposed to radioactivity for a very long time. It becomes embrittled. In other words, you could take, if you had a piece of embrittled concrete, let's say the size of a baseball, you could hit it with a hammer and it would just crack into thousands of little pieces. So this is also what happens inside containment, et cetera, at nuclear power plants. They do have a way of testing that. When they built it, they put in what they call coupons that are supposed to be checked periodically to see if there's any embrittlement. The last time that was done at Diablo, correct me if I'm wrong, Linda, but I think it was 2003?
That's right.
So asking...
Wait a minute. The last time they checked it was 16 years ago?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yes. Nothing could have happened in between then. Go ahead.
Oh, no. No, not at all, of course. So what Harvey is doing has been asking the governor to get involved. Unfortunately, the NRC is the one that has purview over that. But because of the letter that we wrote, the California Public Utilities Commission, who has control over money matters regarding nuclear power plants, they have no purview when it comes to safety, but they do when it comes to economics. So if something's going to cost the ratepayers or the taxpayers money, then the California Public Utilities Commission has purview over that. But this caught their attention, and so they are going to be looking at that. And we just found out about this a couple days ago, so we haven't had a chance to meet and really discuss where we're going from here with that, but it is moving forward.
Diablo Canyon was judged by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 2003 to be one of the five most embrittled reactors in the whole United States. So there's the cracking issue, too. And they found a crack inside of the reactor vessel of Unit 1 several years ago. And they're supposed to test for cracks using ultrasound every 10 years. And that last cracking exam was done in 2005. They're due to do another one in 2015. They applied for an exemption to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they were given that exemption. And now they don't have to do it anymore till that plant shuts down. They're exempt from doing it, even though it is an embrittled reactor vessel. So what our letter says is, come on, this is not an expensive test. It's something that could give a lot of peace of mind to people if you would do it. Just do it. And so that caught the attention of the California Public Utilities Commission, and now it's caught the attention of the California Energy Commission, too. And so hopefully, in addition to this embrittlement issue, they will add on the cracking issue, and we can get some results and find out what is going on inside of there.
Also, interestingly enough, PG&E has actually applied to the NRC to give them an exemption to do any coupon test at Diablo. So I think they probably got wind that this was going to be something that was going to be brought up by people that are concerned and knowledgeable, and so therefore they're trying to circumvent it all by getting a ruling from the NRC that they don't have to do this.
Linda Seeley and Molly Johnson, you are clearly in up past your earlobes in the battle to get Diablo Canyon safely shut down and also to have the waste dealt with in the most responsible way possible, for which I and others here in California and elsewhere who are fighting nuclear salute you. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. We thank you for all that you do. You're a very important part of this movement.
Thank you.
I echo that. Thanks so much, Libby. You just keep on keeping on.
That was Linda Seeley and Molly Johnson of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. You can find those position papers on waste storage, consolidated interim waste, and Yucca Mountain on their website, mothersforpeace.org. On to this next interview, which is short but sweet and delicious. Harvey Wasserman is a veteran anti-nuclear firebrand, an activist, and a brilliant strategist on how to fight this moneyed, powerful, empathy-dead industry. As I mentioned during the interview, I ran into Harvey at last Saturday's Fukushima anniversary screening of Fukushima Speaks, a 2018 documentary by director Toshikuni Doi. After the screening, Harvey spoke to the audience at some length on Diablo Canyon, and, well, I couldn't help but snag him for a brief, fiery rundown on where the fight to close those nukes down is going next.
At Diablo Canyon now, we have a window of opportunity because PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is in bankruptcy. And they are also under criminal parole. They actually have a parole officer because they were convicted of federal crimes related to the 2010 gas explosion in San Bruno, where they incinerated 19 homes and killed 8 people. And now, of course, they've burnt down half of Northern California and killed 80 people, and 10,000 structures have been burned down. So at Diablo Canyon, the reactors are scheduled to close in 24 and 25, although that's not a guarantee because a whole new crew is coming in to run PG&E, and we don't know what they're going to do. Their federal license does expire in 24 and 25, but, you know, a corporation can always get around that. So we want the two reactors at Diablo Canyon to be tested. We know for sure they're embrittled. All old reactors are embrittled. The question is, how embrittled are they? And we also are reasonably sure they're cracked, and we know that they've deferred maintenance. And there's a lot of stuff that they should be doing that they're not doing based on the idea that they're going to shut in 24 and 25. And also they always get around, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. Now, all this stuff is preempted by the feds. The Atomic Energy Act of 1954 says that all safety issues at nuclear power plants are the province of the federal government. Thus, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is completely corrupt. But because they're in bankruptcy and because they're under federal parole, we think that we can get around that. And we're asking the governor and the legislature and friendly congresspeople, including Ted Lieu, to find ways to circumvent this Nuclear Regulatory Commission so we can get these reactors tested and we'll see how embrittled they are and how cracked they are and how much maintenance they've deferred. And in that case, we think that we have a chance to shut Diablo Canyon. Thank God. I mean, Diablo Canyon is half the distance from the San Andreas Fault that Fukushima was from the earthquake that destroyed it. And tsunami is, of course, likely at Diablo. And there are all sorts of other reasons. It sits surrounded by earthquake faults. The power is not needed. There are problems with the waste management. And, of course, you have to ask, is a company that burned down Northern California, blew up San Bruno, in February they burned down five buildings in San Francisco, is this company suitable to be running a nuclear power plant? Even the congressperson from San Luis Obispo, Saud Carbajal, said no, they're not. So we need to find a way around the feds. We need to pressure the governor, pressure the legislature, go after the California Public Utilities Commission, and we need to shut these reactors now. And a lot of people are working on it. And go to hashtag test Diablo and to solartopia.org, and let's see if we can get this done.
That was anti-nuclear veteran firebrand Harvey Wasserman. His radio program is Solartopia and broadcast on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and available on the internet on Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time. He has a petition to test Diablo Canyon nukes at moveon.org. Leave a space and add the word Diablo. Sidebar. Can you imagine naming a nuclear reactor site after the devil? Isn't that tempting fate? End of sidebar. Harvey's website is solartopia.org, and he can be reached by email at solartopia@gmail.com. And of course, we will have his links up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 403. Activist shout out! First of all, acknowledgement, kudos and thanks to all the activists, writers, social media posters, and caring souls who commemorated the earthquake and tsunami which started the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster on March 11, 2011. The comments and reports of actions online were beautiful, inspirational, and worldwide. We will have links up to just some of the brilliant articles and blog posts on our website. They will include links to two Fair Winds Energy Education pieces written by Arne Gunderson and edited by Maggie Gunderson. Both start with the title Atomic Bomb. That's spelled B-A-L-M, as in something that soothes. Part one is entitled Prime Minister Abe Uses the Tokyo Olympics as Snake Oil Cure for the Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Meltdowns. Ain't that the case? And part two is The Run for Your Life Tokyo Olympics. Both are well worth the read, as are so many others of the posts that came out in the last few days. There's a petition that started in France calling for fair judgment for the trial to protect children from irradiation in Fukushima. We'll have a link up to that on our website for you to read the full explanation of the case and have the opportunity to sign. And there's an old saying, it pays to advertise. And now those who oppose nuclear are going for it. In San Diego, California, Public Watchdogs, a San Onofre watchdog group, has been broadcasting TV ads showing the twin Bazumba containment domes as time bombs with lit fuses. And Three Mile Island Alert has gone low-tech but effective with full-size posters at bus stop kiosks in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area. Once we solve the tech, we'll have pictures of both up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, number 403. Here's today's final thought. The actual anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster's start is past, but that doesn't mean that people do not continue to suffer its consequences, because they do. One of the most moving pieces I read was written by a child evacuee from Fukushima. For the purpose of this post, she calls herself Yumi, and she wrote, "Dear citizens and friends, my name is Yumi. I'm a high school student now living in Kyoto, Japan. First, look at this photo of my scribbled note on a sheet of paper." We will have that up on the website. It reads, "I have been through so much pain and sorrow, so I have the right to speak out. Zero nuclear power, no nukes, no bringing in radioactive contaminated waste. I am a child evacuee from the Fukushima nuclear disaster. I wrote it when I was an elementary school student, soon after my mother and I were evacuated together from Fukushima to Kyoto. In nearby communities, my mother was crying out against nuclear power and telling the public how she had struggled to evacuate from the nuclear disaster. At that time, being an elementary school student, I had no choice but to accompany her and listen to her speeches. As a kid, her stories of the nuclear power accident were too difficult to understand, and to be honest, all a bit boring. I remember a drawing pad and writing utensils I always used to take with me to pass the time drawing pictures. In gatherings and meetings, my mother shed tears expressing her 'No to nuclear power, please,' to the public. Suddenly one day, a vision of my grandfather, cousins, and the old classmates I had been parted from, and now far away, appeared in my mind's eye. I felt hatred for nuclear power and the disaster which caused this tragedy to rise up in me. This was how and why, even as a kid, I felt compelled to write down those sentences. 8 years have passed since then. All the feelings I had back then are fading as the years roll by. But whenever I look at this piece of paper, I remember those feelings as clearly as if it was just yesterday. In Fukushima City, where my family lived, due to the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster, they detected 600 times higher doses of radiation than before the accident. However, the government of Japan did not issue an evacuation order for the residents. So far, I haven't had any serious health issues, but a great fear strikes me whenever I hear the child thyroid cancer incidences in Fukushima Prefecture have increased, and especially every time I myself undergo a yearly thyroid medical examination. One reason for this is the memory of the unstoppable nosebleeds I suffered in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. I have heard that the health effects of radiation can occur not only right after the irradiation, but also after many years. And there are not a few cases of this. Along with my mother, I have become a member of plaintiffs of the Kansai class action lawsuit for damages caused by the nuclear accident. The aim is to fight against the government of Japan and TEPCO to create a safer society, which of course includes my family and friends in Fukushima, and to prevent another tragic nuclear accident from ever happening again. Till now, I was just following in my mother's footsteps. However, from now on, as one of the victims of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, I am determined to do what I can on my own, step by step, just as my mother has done and continues to do. We, the nuclear evacuees of Fukushima, thank you for your much-needed continuing support. Thank you. Yumi.
This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for March 12, 2019. Material for this show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, dylanrenard.wordpress.com, and our friend Hervé Courtois, miningawareness.wordpress.com, reviewjournal.com, ecowatch.com, courthousenews.com, Boston Globe, Post and Courier, Cleveland.com, BuzzFeedNews.com, Greenpeace, Mainichi.jp, Rappler.com, TheNational.ae, JapanTimes.co.jp, Fairwinds Energy Education, Beyond Nuclear International, APJIF.org, TaipeiTimes.com, ICANW.org, BBC.com, EdinburghLive.co.uk, SBS.com, The Guardian, WSAU.com,
moneyweb.co.za, sciencealert.com, the pro-nuclear Let's Protect the Owner's Nuclear Investments, forbes.com, the soul-dead cubicle drones who push propaganda, write press releases, is there a difference, for World Nuclear News, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, I want to thank all of you for listening, and a big shout-out to Nuclear Hot Seat followers around the world. You know, we are in at least 123 countries on 6 continents. Gratitude to Julie Steelman, a dear friend and brilliant wildlife photographer who tried to access the show while on a photographic journey to Antarctica. She was trying to give us our 7th continent, but was unable to catch a signal. Too bad. But at least someone in Antarctica tried. And welcome to everyone who's listening wherever you are, including those of you on our growing network of broadcast stations around the U.S. If you know of a community radio station that would like to carry a nuclear show, contact the Pacifica Audio Port Network, or you can contact me at info@nuclearhotseat.com. Thanks for visiting the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. It's the blog page with the red and black logo, not the podcast page. And if you haven't yet, please click like, follow, post, and share. You can find all of our back episodes, all 402 of them, at nuclearhotseat.com. And a clickable Excel spreadsheet has just been created that will allow you to easily navigate between the episodes. We'll be making that available to subscribers within the next few weeks. And you can learn more about my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat, by going to Amazon.com, which is where it's available. If you want to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, you won't lose a single episode, and it's easy. Just go to NuclearHotSeat.com, go to the yellow box, scroll down a bit for it, and sign up. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@NuclearHotSeat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment and support the work by sending a donation of any size to NuclearHotSeat.com. We always appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevy and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating that nuclear waste is forever, but we don't even know what to do with it now. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.